This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson here while Terry Gross is on vacation. My guest, Daniel Callahan, is a philosopher residing in the world of medicine. He's the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center, a think tank that addresses the ethical questions that face our healthcare industry. Callahan's books include Setting Limits, which looks at healthcare for the elderly, and Abortion, Law, Choice, and Morality. His new book is What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. Callahan argues that decisions on how we allocate our healthcare funds are based on values, and he questions the values behind our current healthcare priorities. He believes we spend a disproportionate amount on costly, high-tech medicine to extend life by extraordinary means, at the expense of basic care for the poor, the elderly, and children. Callahan argues for a centralized plan that would set limits on costly operations such as transplants. Daniel Callahan begins his new book with the case of Adam Howard, a young man who died of leukemia in 1987 while trying to raise $100,000 to pay for a bone marrow transplant operation. He was the first victim of a new Oregon law that stopped funding organ transplants for welfare recipients and transferred the money to prenatal care. I asked Daniel Callahan if he felt that the law that blocked this life-saving operation was cold-hearted indifference by the state.
There really was no indifference there. The voters of Oregon had earlier established a limitation on expenditures, and the state had spent all of the money the voters would allow them to spend, and the legislature had to then make a decision about where to make some fundamental cuts. And they decided that the organ transplantation program, which costs something in the vicinity of $1 million a year, really had money in it that could be better used, they felt, for prenatal care. And what they did was transfer the money from transplantation to prenatal care. And the net result was they helped some 1,500 women, but at the cost possibly of the loss of one or two lives of people who might have been saved by organ transplant. So it was not indifference or insensitivity. I would bring the question right back to the whole idea of voters telling legislatures you can only spend so much money, because you really see the consequences here. You leave very hard decisions in the hands of officials, and there's no happy choice they can make in that case.
You've advocated a basic national level of health care, a guaranteed minimal level of care that would take care of the basics to basically keep us all going day in and day out, in part so that we could continue to take care of ourselves, but there will have to be limits attached to this. And I'm wondering about this idea of limits. When you're standing next to the bedside of somebody who could be improved by an incremental advance or application of some technology, and somebody has decided, no, that person can't have that medicine, can't have that treatment, I think that sort of really focuses away from the abstract and onto the personal in a way that would make it very hard to make a decision like you're advocating.
It is very hard where it has to take place, such as happened in Oregon a couple of years, and it's inevitably going to be hard. I think what one has to understand, however, is that if you don't make these hard decisions, you're going to pay a price somewhere else. If you don't say no to certain kinds of expensive treatment, you can be pretty sure you're probably going to be hurting the health of some other people, or you're going to be hurting other social goods. I suppose the real tragedy here, and for me the hardest part of all this, is what do you do with those very touching, very demanding individual cases? I think we have to keep in mind that the human body does eventually age and die. We will decline. We are mortal creatures. So inevitably, there's going to come a point where we're going to be on a trajectory of decline, and it may be simply reasonable to say, look, even though we could do more, perhaps we shouldn't try, because simply we have to accept death.
The medical profession has advanced technically so far that it seems that with the exception, I think, of AIDS and terminal cancer, just about anything seems to be curable nowadays, sometimes at great expense. Are you saying this is no longer a wise decision that doctors should make or patients should make?
The problem is that we have found more and more expensive ways to keep human bodies going. We know how to take care of very low birth weight babies. We know how to take care of very elderly people. We know how to take care of people whose organs are failing. The problem is that the progress is enormously expensive. There turn out to be very few inexpensive ways any longer of saving and prolonging life. 50 or 100 years ago, when we were still dealing with infectious disease, smallpox or diphtheria or typhoid, Then we were able eventually to come up with the vaccines and find inexpensive treatments. But now we're dealing with cancer and heart disease and stroke and Alzheimer's. Those diseases turn out to be very expensive to control. So the problem is, how in the world are we going to pay for the high cost of further medical progress and at the same time not bankrupt ourselves and actually do ourselves some good?
Several years ago, I remember seeing the first sonogram machines and was startled to see that you could actually look at the living, moving organs inside the body with ultrasound, a non-intrusive, non-invasive, and a relatively benign way of examining the human body. And this seemed to be a wonderful form of technology, but I was also seeing it through the viewpoint then of the people who were inventing the machines and devising them and marketing them. And this particular sonogram that was being sold was black and white. There were plans to introduce a color model that would be more expensive, and eventually the sonogram machine became a very elaborate tool that's used extensively now, but there's an entire sort of electronics, medical technology industry that's driving some of this. Are you saying slow down, stop inventing devices such as the sonogram machine?
I admit that I am highly ambivalent and troubled on this particular issue. I think it's very difficult to say out loud, look, let's stop progress, let's slow down progress, let's somehow put the brakes on our understanding of human nature and biology. At the same time, it seems to me that if we develop all kinds of expensive devices, drugs, what have you, inevitably there's enormous pressure toward using them. It's very hard to have something that will benefit somebody and then not to use it. So I suppose I would like, my compromise, I suppose, would be to just say, look, we've got to have progress. It's a good thing, but let's go at it very carefully. Let's look before we leap. Let's begin to consider what the economic consequences of the technology will be, what some of the social, what some of the cultural consequences are going to be. And then if we still think it's worth it, let's go ahead. What I suppose I want is a real sense of foresight and prudence and care. I mean, the sonogram is a wonderful example of something that does have benefits. It does provide knowledge of the fetus, which can be very valuable. Frequently, of course, that knowledge has led to a greater use of cesareans, which drives the cost of health care up. And at the same time as we were developing the sonogram, keep in mind we were also seeing a continuing development of prenatal diagnosis and other means of monitoring the health of fetuses. So if you look back over a period of 20 years and ask, my gosh, what has happened to childbirth, what you see is not just a sonogram, you see a whole array of technological developments, which has radically driven up the cost of having a child. Now, we're getting healthier children, for the most part, out of that. Though, ironically, at least with the poor, we're often getting sicker children because they're not having access, they're not even getting old-fashioned prenatal care. But on the whole, what we see is not just one technology with childbirth, but you're seeing a whole lot of technologies, and it's the total impact which really creates the problem, I believe. We'll have to slow this down. We can't keep going forward as fast as we do. Yet, at the same time, that won't be easy because it goes against our grain to talk about slowing down progress.
My guest is Daniel Callahan, author of the book, What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. Given the amount of money that's gone into AIDS research, do you feel that this is a worthwhile investment vis-a-vis other costs? I certainly know that I've heard doctors say, why should we treat people who have AIDS? They won't live very long anyway. These kinds of issues seem to be getting right to the heart of what you're interested in.
Oh, absolutely. The AIDS crisis is a sort of horrible test case, I suppose. There are really three things to be thought about when considering AIDS. First of all, money to be spent on basic research looking for a cure for the disease. Secondly, money spent on education and prevention campaigns, trying to keep the disease from spreading. Thirdly, money to be spent on health care for people who actually come down with AIDS. To me, the most important thing would be the first two phases. The research phase, simply because it is an infectious disease, we want to stop it. It's imperative that we stop it. Secondly, it's important that we try to educate people to behave in ways that will keep them from getting the disease in the first place. That's fundamental to keep the burden down. And thirdly, we then have to ask the question, well, how much and what kind of money should we spend on those who have had the misfortune to actually get the disease? To me, part of that is very troubling. What we're coming to, I believe, is we're finding more and more very expensive ways to keep AIDS victims alive. AZT is a pretty good example, costing now anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 a year. It's helpful. It's important for AIDS victims, but it's enormously expensive. What I foresee in the future is we may well find some increasingly expensive ways to extend the life of AIDS victims, but not save those lives. We'll turn it into a very expensive kind of a long-term chronic disease. That, to me, is very, very troubling. And I suppose the question that I puzzle about is how much should we spend on the education, the research side, over against the therapy side for those that have it. My own bias, I suppose, in general, it with limited resources, is to spend the money for the research and the education. But at the same time, it's very hard to say no to something that can extend the life of an AIDS victim.
And there are clearly those who have AIDS who are quite adventuresome in the world of in the way of seeking out possible cures, and almost running head on into the bureaucracies in this country, who are saying, no, we won't let you try this new drug, we won't let you try that new treatment, whereas they are expressing an interest in trying anything possible. It seems to me there's a new advocacy coming from people who have AIDS that we haven't seen from patients before.
Well,
there's a political issue involved, too.
That's true. The AIDS, many of the organizations that are looking at for AIDS victims are very vocal, and they're very effective lobbying groups. And they've certainly brought about some fundamental changes in the release of experimental drugs. It's interesting that, I mean, there are many more cancer victims in this country, many more people who are trying to get very experimental cancer drugs that can't get them. Yet their complaints over the years pretty much went unheeded. And the reason, of course, was not a bad reason. There really have been very strong efforts to keep off the market quack remedies, things that will actually do more harm than good. And it's very, very important to really adequately test drugs to find out what works and what doesn't work. The AIDS advocates have pretty much cracked through that earlier system of cautions and barriers, and they made a big difference. Sometimes I suppose the difference is beneficial. And yet, at the same time, in a way, there are many other victims and many other diseases that aren't getting nearly the attention that the AIDS people are getting.
One of the issues, particularly in the Bay Area, is that the emergency rooms are often filled with people who have been either dealing crack or been involved in a crack or a cocaine deal and have been shot or stabbed or beaten up in some way, where emergency rooms are now being turned over to people who are involved in the crack business. This is putting an enormous strain on the emergency rooms there. What kind of ethical questions do you see being raised here?
Oh, gosh, the state of emergency rooms in many of, if not most of our large cities is absolutely terrible. There's an enormous problem, certainly in New York City and in the Bay Area, but it's also true in Houston, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., everywhere. There are a couple of ethical problems that are raised here. First of all, if we really try to meet the demand and increase the emergency room facilities, then, of course, unless we're prepared to see a great increase in taxes, we're going to have to take money from other health care needs. So that's one dilemma. How do you balance off the emergency room needs, particularly with problems generated by the whole drug crisis, over against other health care needs? I suppose the problem also that surfaces, people talk about at any rate, is how can we justify spending large amounts of money for people who are actually bringing their problems upon themselves by engaging in the life of life of violence and crime? Because what happens in many of these emergency rooms is that the same people come back again and again, particularly not just the victims of gunshot and wounds and stabbing wounds that come from sort of the commercial fights that go on in the drug scene. But of course, people who are themselves drug addicts who come back for the third, fourth, fifth time, many people who are drug addicts develop very serious heart problems. And I've talked with any number of emergency room physicians and who say, look, it's an enormous frustration when you see the same patient coming back for the fourth time with the same heart condition brought on by the same addiction. And what do you do? How do you justify spending tens of thousands of dollars to pull this patient through again, knowing he's going to go right back out on the streets, develop the very same condition, and be back in here again? The ethic of medicine says that you should treat regardless of how people get sick, and that's a wonderful ethic. On the same time, we're developing an emergency room situation where all sorts of legitimate needs are going unmet, and we're really largely catering to what is really a social crisis in this country, which is sort of has a terrible medical spin-off, but is essentially not. I mean, the drug crisis is not ultimately a medical problem, but it sure produces lots of medical casualties.
How did you decide to become a medical ethicist?
Well, my background is in philosophy, and I've had a long-standing interest back to my graduate school days in moral philosophy. And toward the end of the 1960s, I became interested really in taking philosophy much more out into the world, much as Socrates did out into the marketplace. And it seemed obvious at that time that one of the major areas of moral concern, moral dilemma, would be the area of medicine. Even 20, 25 years ago, organ transplantations were just beginning. Questions were being raised about the definition of death. And, of course, we had the abortion debate, which is still with us. We've had debates about surrogate motherhood, artificial reproduction. And it was pretty obvious that these moral problems were going to be very important. They were going to be very tough. And it struck me that there was a wonderful role, a kind of new role for philosophers, and I decided to really turn my interest in that direction.
I'm curious what role a medical ethics center has within the larger medical community. How is it viewed by practitioners in the field of medicine?
Well, the Hastings Center, which I direct, has now been in existence 20 years. 20 years ago, when we began, I think reasonable to say that there was a great deal of suspicion, sometimes even hostility, and just an enormous amount of indifference. That has changed very significantly. The interesting thing is that many of the ethical issues that were seen as kind of science fiction problems or at the fringe of medicine have now come to the very center of medicine. Certainly there have been enormous changes in the doctor-patient relationship. We now talk much more about the rights of patients, the necessity of physicians to really have good, open, solid dialogue with their patients. The physicians themselves recognize the enormous financial pressures their patients are under, and in fact, the enormous financial pressures faced by the whole system. So in general, I find them very interested, very receptive, puzzled like the rest of us, but as a group, quite prepared to deal with the ethical problems and quite willing to understand that we face some tough choices, that those choices have to be shared, between doctors and lay people. In the history of medicine, it was very uncommon for doctors to really talk with anyone other than doctors about moral problems. And I suppose over the past 20 years, perhaps the most dramatic change has been that the ethical issues are now discussed very openly, obviously in the media. They're discussed between doctors and patients. They really come to the very heartland of medicine itself.
In part, wasn't a lot of this sort of fueled by lawsuits in which doctors suddenly found themselves answering for decisions that they had made before that they had not had to talk about before?
There's no doubt that probably by the mid-70s, there were a whole range of court cases that began to develop in this area. There were disputes between doctors and patients. The most famous, I suppose, in the 1970s was the Karen Ann Quinlan case, where the parents of that young woman wanted to have treatment stopped on her. The doctors did not want to stop the treatment, and they took that case to the New Jersey Supreme Court, and the court decided eventually in favor of the parents. That was followed by a whole string of court cases, and they go on to this very day. Right now, there's a case before the United States Supreme Court, the Nancy Cruzan case, about which bears on the stopping of artificial nutrition and hydration. So there have been, every year there's been a major court case, it seems. And increasingly, too, these issues are being taken to legislatures, which are passing laws and establishing policies and trying to come to grips with these problems.
I wonder if there's been anything in your own life that has raised these issues for you in a very immediate way.
Two or three things raised them. First of all, I have adult children, and I became aware a few years ago of how difficult it is for them to buy housing. And one thing that began striking me was that the resources in this country that are going to the elderly have now begun to very significantly exceed resources going to the young. I suppose, secondly, I have seen more and more people dying amidst a very costly treatment, and particularly seeing more and more people who have become almost really fearful of contemporary medicine. They're afraid that they're going to be impoverished. They're going to have to spend an enormous amount of money on their health care, which is going to financially ruin them. They have become scared of spending their lives demented for many years, say, in a nursing home. And people are just talk about that a lot, and particularly what I see is that sort of the next age group up, the people 10 or 15 years older than myself, are living out these problems, and it's getting nearer and nearer to my own case, and I'm trying to think a bit ahead. My gosh, what do I want when I'm older? What would count as a good healthcare system? And yet at the same time, I don't want to sort of promote a healthcare system that is going to impoverish the young of the country or so imbalance things toward one group that other social needs just go wanting. I'm also, I suppose, I've become very interested in recent years in the fate of the American education system. I'm very disturbed to see our relative standing compared with all other countries is declining. Our kids seem to know less and less. Our schools seem to be poorer and poorer. But meanwhile, we spend more and more money on health care. And I suppose when I ask about the future of a country, my own guess is the future is probably going to be determined much more by what we spend on education in this country than it is by what we spend on health care.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming and being with us on Fresh Air today. Daniel Callahan is the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center and author of the new book, What Kind of Life? The Limits of Medical Progress. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.